who exactly is Uncle Robert, and what is a cult?
I love being able to share my story, use it as a cautionary tale to encourage others and also maybe educate others. So yeah, Brittany, thanks for the opportunity to share my story with your audience, because again, I think it's an important one and I am happy to share it.
You're up, you're ready, and you're listening to the Brittany Mac Podcast. Everyone has a story, applying them to inspire the world weekly on Motivation Mondays. Here's your host, Brittany Mac.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Brittany Mac Podcast. Today we have Mr. Peter Young. Mr. Peter Young lived in a tiny religious cult for 20 years, but was finally rescued. His story exposes how secrecy protects cults and how to recover. Mr. Peter was a sports broadcaster for over 20 years, telling stories of great athletes all over the world while working for CBS, ESPN, OLN, and other networks. Welcome, Mr. Peter. Introduce yourself to everyone.
Yeah, Brittany, thank you very much for having me on the show. And hi to everybody. You know, I was a sports broadcaster for a long time. I covered all the events that hardly anybody watched. I used to joke I was the Bob Costas of sports nobody watched. But I did lumberjack events. I did skiing and cycling. I did an adventure race in the Sahara Desert in Morocco. And all over the United States, and, you know, college basketball and football and track and field, all that kind of stuff. So I got to meet a lot of really interesting people, got to work with a lot of great people. But it's funny, Brittany, because, you know, again, like I've been all over the world, either as a sports broadcaster or before that when I played basketball in college. And so you think when you travel that much, you'll see fascinating and interesting and, let's say, odd people. Mm-hmm. But the oddest and strangest people in my life were the ones that were right here in my home here in when I was living in Idaho and Montana.
Wow.
So that's a bit of my background.
You have a very interesting background, and your background goes to show that people that are in cults can be just everyday people around us that's doing things right along with us, and we see every day, and we wouldn't know that they are going through something like being in a cult.
So, Brittany, you're right. That was probably one of the more profound lessons that I learned from what happened to me. I really kind of married into a cult. I married the love of my life, you know, over 25 years ago. And I knew she had, you know, what was described to me as, quote unquote, the family guru. Well, who is this guy and how bad could he be? And I was in love. I knew I wanted to marry this person. And this person was called Uncle Robert, which he was not related. He's a guy that's now in his late 70s, born and raised in Syria, came to America and married an American woman and really kind of glommed onto my former wife's family. And so he was always there in the picture. But then as the years progressed with my marriage, we had a bunch of kids, we had five children, he just slowly but surely began to take over our lives. And so, you know, I'm jumping around a lot, but I want to just give you a synopsis. So, you know, eventually there was cognitive dissonance in my former wife where, you know, I think for a time she did love me, but she clearly adored and revered this Uncle Robert more than anybody. And I asked too many questions. You know, I asked, well, why do you believe this? Why do you believe that? And you know, he had just come to dominate our marriage and our family. So she eventually left me, which is really what kind of kicked me out of the cult. It's a tiny little cult. It's only, you know, maybe 10 or 12 people at that. And when I finally started to reach out to friends and family, you know, I hadn't shared with them what was going on. Like nobody knew. So when I released my book last month in March and people read it, you know, people here in the church community, neighbors and friends, they say, oh my gosh, Peter, I had no idea. And I say, it's okay. Nobody did. And again, the important point, Brittany, is that's how cults maintain their control, is through secrecy and paranoia. So, you know, the paranoia is, well, everybody's out to get us, or nobody would understand, you know, whoever the leader of the cult is, right? Nobody would understand him or her. He's too brilliant. She's too brilliant. So then the paranoia kicks into secrecy. Well, we have to keep all this quiet. We can't let anybody know because then they'll come after Uncle Robert or whoever the leader is. And so you don't tell anybody. And of course, as soon as I started sharing emails and letters that I was still getting, this is about 5 years ago, from my, we were still married, and so from her and then from Uncle Robert, you know, I would share these with people because I was really struggling at the time. You know, they were alarmed by what was being written and said. And so they stepped in and helped out. And yet you would look at me, I was a sports broadcaster, I was a real estate broker. You know, you would never know that this was happening right underneath your nose, right in your neighborhood. And so, you know, think about your friends and your family, people you go to church with, you work with, go to school, et cetera. You never know if something like this is happening within your sphere of influence or your circle. And so along the lines of, you know, this is how this happens with secrecy, then well, what do we do about it? Well, you know, if you see someone in your sphere of influence that you know that's, you know, kind of taken a turn in their demeanor or their relationships where they kind of cut everybody off, they don't call anymore, they don't write anymore, you don't see them at church, you don't see them at work, whatever, ask questions, reach out. And for me, our change was so subtle that, you know, again, it took almost 20 years of, you know, living, let's say, a fairly normal life to, you know, we stopped going to church, we stopped listening to anybody else. Every single decision was run by Uncle Robert. And it was crazy. And if I had involved, you know, my family, so my parents are still alive, you know, they're in their 80s, and my brothers, their wives, et cetera, I don't, you know, there would have been intervention sooner. And, you know, I think 2020, and that's okay. But that's the lesson for other people, right? If you see something wrong, reach out, ask questions.
So I want to ask two questions to start off.
Mm-hmm.
Who exactly is Uncle Robert? And what is a cult?
Sure. So Uncle Robert, I'll just not even say his last name. His last name is in the book. So again, I just wrote a book. It's my memoir. It tells the whole story. It's called Stop the Tall Man, Save the Tiger. And he was called Uncle Robert because as children, my former wife, she's one of five, and their siblings, they would call adults uncle or aunt as a sign of respect. Well, the uncle just kind of stuck, so he was always called Uncle Robert. And he was the little cult leader. And all cults look different, right? You know, some are real big. You know, you think about Jonestown. People drank the Kool-Aid back in the 70s and that massacre. I think Heaven's Gate back in the 90s. You know, people thought they were going to get whisked off into space on some spaceship. And you know, they look, and David Koresh and his folks, they all look a little different. But they all have one thing in common, which is a leader. And it's oftentimes it's a man, usually it's a man. Very narcissistic, charismatic, and you know, he makes the rules, and everybody else has to follow the rules but him. And that's exactly what we had. You know, our little cult may not have looked like most others, but we had Uncle Robert. He was the leader. His word was unquestioned, and, you know, he usually did not have to, you know, follow the rules, but everybody else did. Again, yeah, he was a guy who was, you know, born in Syria, very intelligent, you know, read the Bible over numerous times. So, you know, and when people say, well, how in the world did you get swallowed up in this? You know, nobody just starts believing lies. And cult leaders don't just start sharing and spouting off lies. They take the truth. So they start with the truth, but then they twist it, Brittany. So they twist it a little bit here, there, like 1%, 2%. And you keep doing that day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. Well, before you know it, you know, you are far from the truth. And that's how it happens. And he, Uncle Robert, was very good at that. So he would often, you know, read from the Bible. He would talk about our Christian faith. But, you know, over the years, it became, wow, something that was very different than what I know to be the truth of the Christian faith. And he had met my former wife's parents at a seminary, a tiny little seminary, in Southern California back in, like, the early 70s. So my former wife, you know, she knows no other life. He was always around. He was always the authority on everything. For instance, her father, so my former father-in-law, calls Uncle Robert Dad. Well, that means my former father-in-law and mother-in-law will call him Dad. During the really hard times when she had left me and taken our three youngest children with her, our children called him Grandpa Bob. And again, he's not related to us at all. He looks very different for us. And so, yeah, he was our little cult leader. And one of the most wicked things that he did was the cult leaders, And again, they want absolute control. And to get that, they have to kind of destroy the family. So in other words, that the people in the cult, whether it's a child or a grandchild or a parent or a grandparent, they're all kind of children underneath the cult leader. So therefore, the lines of family are blurred. So, you know, I was no longer a father to my children. I was a blood donor. They called me a sperm donor, a bloodline, because they had to dismiss me as the father because then Uncle Robert was going to take over as father, just like my former father-in-law would call him dad. So he, you know, would blur all these lines, and everybody would be, in essence, like a child under the thumb and direction of Uncle Robert. And I talk about it now, Brittany, it just sounds so bizarre. But when it happens really slowly in front of you, it's hard to see the big picture. And I didn't see it for a long time.
Wow. So how would you explain, or what is your definition of a cult?
Okay. What is a cult? Well, again, I think they look different. They come in all shapes and sizes. But to me, first and foremost, there is a cult leader. And the cult leader makes the rules, but the rules don't apply to him or her. And they are in complete control. And other features of a cult that you will see, no matter what the cult looks like, is a certain level of paranoia and secrecy. The cult leader will instill in everybody the paranoia that, hey, everybody's out to get us, so we need to keep it quiet. So there is secrecy where what they do or believe in is not shared. And then there is a blurring of the family lines where if families get involved in a cult, the cult leader becomes the father, let's say, of everybody. So, you know, grandparents and parents and children, you know, they all become on the same level and the cult leader has control. And Brittany, for some people, like I remember when I first kind of got out of it, because I was wrapped in it. You know, for years, I really thought Uncle Robert was crazy. I really did. Oh my gosh, this guy bothers me, but I went along to get along with my wife. But for about 2.5 years, I was in. You know, I just kept getting beaten down over and over, kept getting told how brilliant this guy is. And I finally caved. And I was brainwashed for about 2 years. I came out of it, and I'm a much stronger person now. But I remember when people would first say, well, that was a cult. And boy, that word would rub me wrong. But I read a book about it, and the author describes it as undue mind control. And I thought, well, there you go. I mean, that is the essence of a cult, right? Mm-hmm. Whether or not everybody, you know, shaves their hair off or wears certain clothing or walks around town banging a drum, chanting weird slogans, or doesn't do any of that. We didn't do any of that. It's the mind control. And so just like a teacher or a coach or a parent can have positive mind control, right? Like you're encouraging the child. The opposite is what cult leaders do. It's undue mind control. They, you know, convince them to do things that are not in a person's best self-interest. And that's exactly what cult leaders do. And that's exactly what Uncle Robert did.
So it was a small religious cult, am I right?
Yes, it was. Yep. And so, you know, again, we would have what's called these little conferences. And I talk about it in my book. You know, Brittany, if you and I were to get together over a cup of coffee or a beer, it would be a meeting, or if a bunch of your friends came, it'd be, I don't know, a gathering, a party, whatever. But when we would go to Northern Idaho, where my in-laws lived, and Uncle Robert would show up, it was always a conference. And there was a glorified way of saying we would sit around in the living room, and he would talk for like hours and hours and hours. And we would just sit there and listen to his crazy ideas. But again, yeah, he started off reading the Bible. At times he's very knowledgeable about it, but then he would just put his little spin on it. So the analogy I give is that I don't know if you play golf, but you know, if you miss hit a golf ball by like a quarter of an inch, or just a little bit, you know, 100 yards down the fairway, the golf ball is going to be, you know, way off to the right or way off to the left, nowhere near where you intended it to go. Well, that's the same way with him. And I would imagine with other religious cults, they'll take Bible or whatever book they're reading from, and the cult leader puts his own spin on it, and before you know it, you are so far from the truth from where you started. But again, it's subtle. It takes time. And then it sinks in.
How did you get sucked into a small religious cult?
Well, I got sucked into this tiny little cult because I married into it. So I in the book, Stop the Tall Man, Save the Tiger, I called her Paige. I changed most people's first name just to give them a bit of privacy. And so I will call her Paige. And I met her in Idaho. I was a sports broadcaster. I worked at the local TV station. And she was this beautiful, 6'1", tall, athletic woman with beautiful long blonde hair. And I remember seeing her around town. And I fell in love when I met her at a singles Bible study. And I mean, I didn't follow her right away. But about 2 weeks later, I did. And but a guy had told me before I even met her, I started to describe her. I hadn't met her yet. I was at the weight room. And this guy's like, oh, yeah, that's so-and-so, that's Paige. And but be careful, she's got this weird family guru. So before I ever even met her, I knew about the weird family guru. And then we met and dated. And, you know, we were married 9 months later. And she was the love of my life. I truly felt the Lord had introduced us. We met at a singles Bible study. And then, you know, slowly but surely, I heard about Uncle Robert. I thought, oh, here we go. Here's the weird guru. And I thought, well, I need to meet him because I knew I wanted to marry her. And so we met in late October. I met her father about a month later around Thanksgiving because she talked about him all the time. I thought, okay, you know, he's a little odd, but seems like a nice man. And then I finally met Uncle Robert in April. So like, what, 6 months later? And I thought, well, he's kind of odd, kind of weird, but, you know, seemingly harmless. So shortly after meeting him, it was at one of her brother's weddings, I asked her to marry me. We got married 3 months later, and 10 months after that, our first child came. And so the first few years of our marriage, Brittany, you know, he was always around there. Now, he lived in California, so he wasn't physically close by. But, you know, my former wife would call him quite often. It wasn't until, you know, 4 or 5 years in that it slowly but surely started to become more and more of an issue. And I, again, went along to get along. So I should have, looking back, said, wait a minute, this guy is crazy. Or, you know, honey, sweetheart, do you really believe this? You know, look what he's saying. And I didn't, and I should have, but I let it go on too long to the point where it was too late. So that's how I got sucked in.
What was he saying? And also, I want to ask, what were some of the beliefs in the cults?
Well, he espoused some quite odd beliefs. He had a very unique perspective on the Bible and that, you know, modern history really dates back to these two brothers, Jacob and Esau. And there's, you know, a story about them in Genesis, and they play a pivotal role. And so the descendants of Jacob and Esau, basically, I mean, I'm really kind of simplifying this, would become Christians and Jews of today. And so Robert coming from Syria, you know, the Middle East, you know, there would be quite a bit of anti-Semitic feeling in that region. And so to him, you know, every war, depression, recession, everything bad that happens would be a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world. I thought, wow, really? Like, you know, that seems kind of odd to me. You know, one of my buddies from high school and college is a Jewish guy. I was at his wedding. He was in mine, you know. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, like, he would have no idea what Uncle Robert's talking about. So that was one of them. That was part of his, you know, theology. And then other ones are really weird, too. Like, he thought casinos were churches. So, like, he said, true worship in America is in casinos. I thought, okay, really? And the idea was that anybody could go into a casino and be blessed by the Lord, whether you're smart or dumb or, you know, male or female, popular or not, whatever it is, you can go in and be blessed by the Lord. Okay, but, you know, when I go into a casino, I see people worshiping money. You know, I see people desperate. I don't see people worshiping the Lord. And then he also called it his office. So he would go to casinos to try and earn money. Now, those are just two examples. There's a lot of weird stuff. And again, you know, we live in, well, we used to, but we kind of live in a free country still. You're allowed to have weird ideas, right? Like, you're allowed to be odd. That's okay. Nothing wrong with that. You might be really weird. You might even be sick, but you're allowed to. But when you start taking it to the next level of the undue mind control, especially when it influences children, well, that's not okay. And so that's where, you know, people might say, well, what's the big deal? You know, he had some odd beliefs. Well, he did. But then when you start, you know, using those odd beliefs to brainwash children, to brainwash people to, you know, break up families and marriages, well, that's not okay.
So I'm guessing that when you were seeing his beliefs and the things he was saying, that's when you realized that it was a small cult?
You know, it took a long time. I think early on, before I, you know, again, about 15 years into the marriage, I finally was probably beaten down. And Brittany, I would say I was quote unquote brainwashed for maybe 2 years, 2.5. You know, it's a little uncomfortable for me to say that, but it's true. I mean, it probably was. I think, wow. I mean, but it took a long time. So I remember, I'll give you a story, 9/11. So I'm old enough to remember the attacks on 9/11. I grew up in New Jersey. I had a high school classmate who was widowed that day on 9/11. Her husband died in one of the Twin Towers. I had other friends who were in the Twin Towers who got out that day. So about a year after 9/11, or shortly thereafter 9/11, we were at one of our little conferences, and Uncle Robert was there. And he started to say that, you know, on 9/11, you know, 80,000 people died. I go, oh, wait a minute. I always heard the number was roughly around 3,000. And then he's just basically blamed it all on the Jews. And he was a very angry, bitter, you know, the way he said it. And I remember, again, I talk about this in my book, that, you know, growing up, you know, I'm a white guy. I had black friends. I had Jewish friends. I had Italian friends. I had Greek friends. And we all kind of made fun of each other. Everybody did it, right? We didn't take it that seriously. This is back when you used to be able to joke, right? And nobody got too offended. You know, we all, because nobody was immune. Boy, when Uncle Robert said this, man, I was quite honestly afraid, because I knew that my in-laws and my wife at the time revered the guy, and I thought he was crazy. And it was probably the first time, maybe around 2001, so 4 years after we got married, I thought, this guy's a danger. Like, he's really dangerous. And I told my wife at the time that, and I didn't follow up, and I should have. And so then when I really realized it was the call, it wasn't until I got out. But I had known years before that this guy was dangerous, and I was either not brave enough, smart enough, or whatever, to not take a stand, and I should have.
What are some of the signs of a cult? Because I know you say you are never aware that you're in a cult until you have been rescued or until you've gotten out of the cult.
I do believe that's true. I know it's certainly true for my case. Because again, if we think about, you know, being in a cult as undue mind control, right? Like, that's where the real control is. It's in the person's mind. So obviously, if they're in a cult, they don't realize it, right? I mean, if they realize they're in a cult, well, they wouldn't be in the cult, because the cult leader or the group had not controlled that person's mind. So the moment you get controlled by the cult, obviously you don't see it, all right? So when you're in it, you don't see it. It's once you realize, oh my gosh, this is really weird. This is a cult. Ta-da, you're out, because it no longer has control over your mind. So in our case, there was no real outward manifestation of it. There was some, but again, we didn't all move into a commune. We didn't all shave our heads or wear weird clothing or, you know, marry our cousin or whatever. We didn't do any of that kind of stuff. Nothing weird sexually or odd like that. But it definitely controlled our minds. And the biggest, let's say, sign of it, you know, like if you knew me, Brittany, like, and you and I were in our neighborhood, we went to church together, whatever, you'd be like, man, Peter and his family are really quiet. Haven't heard them in a while. He never says anything at work. He stopped going to church. And they've got this weird guy, Uncle Robert, that they keep talking about. And that would have really been the only outward sign that we were in a cult.
Wow. You know, that really reminds me, when you say you don't know you're in a cult until you've gotten out, that reminds me of a quote by Harriet Tubman. She said that she freed 1,000 slaves, and she could have freed 1,000 more if only they knew they were slaves. So people usually say, in a lot of situations, like when you're inside of something, you can't really see clearly until you've on the outside looking in. And now you're like, oh my gosh, look at what was going on. And you come to realization. So that definitely reminds me of that, even though I know a slave and being in a cult, two different things, but that definitely reminds me of that.
Yeah, well, no, it's very applicable. It's a good quote that you brought up, because that's how really people get controlled. First and foremost is in the mind versus, you know, physically, right? If you control somebody in the mind, you really don't need to control them all that much physically, you know, with chains or whatever, if you controlled their mind, you control the person. I remember a story. I was recovered and out, and I realized Uncle Robert was dangerous and was a little tiny cult. And I had really tried to, you know, prevent the divorce and, you know, try to keep my family intact. Unfortunately, I failed. We did get divorced. But an old college friend of mine, and I had filled her in on all this. She lives across the country. And we used to do what's called tithing. So, you know, in your Christian faith, you take 10% of what you make and give it back to the church. They call it tithing. Well, over the years, we tithe everything to Uncle Robert. So our family, one of my former wife's brothers, and then her parents, right? So we're all sending money to this guy. And remember, he liked to go to the casinos. He called them his office. He would go there and try to, quote unquote, earn money. And at the time, you know, when I was in all this, it was a little weird, but yeah, not too bad. You know, oh, Uncle Robert, he always wins at the casino. It's amazing. He's brilliant, blah, blah, blah. And my friend of mine's like, wait a minute, Peter, all of you guys sent him money every month, and he went to the casinos all the time. And I remember as soon as she said that, I thought, oh, when you put it like that, yeah, it's really weird. But nobody did at the time. It wasn't until I got out of it, and I had a friend who could see clearly, right? She never had any affiliation with this Uncle Robert guy. She was just a friend of mine from college. And so when she was able to succinctly describe it that way, oh man, the light bulb goes on. Like, wow, yeah, that was really weird. But when you're in it, it's hard to see it at times, right? What's the phrase? You know, it's hard to see the forest for the trees or vice versa. You live it every day, and it's hard to really take a step back and think, well, wait a minute, what is going on here? Of course, now I can, now that I'm healthy, and I became healthy, first and foremost, by the Lord. You know, I firmly believe that he rescued me from this. So I'm a million times stronger than I ever was. I wish I could have learned this lesson differently, not had my family get broken up by it. But also the friends and family that reached out. You know, friends and family that I've had for decades, even though I hadn't kept in touch with them much while I was kind of in the cult, they were still there. They were still friends. They were still family. So they were able to help me see and help me recover.
So before I ask my next question, which is how were you able to recover, take us back to the moment when you came to the realization and you were rescued. When you were rescued, what were those feelings like in that moment, and what did that look like?
Well, good question. I would say there was no one moment where the light bulb came on where I realized it. It was more of like, if I could continue the analogy, you know, where you have a dimmer switch for your light, you know, where it's off and then you slowly turn it up and the light slowly comes on in the living room or the kitchen or wherever. Mm-hmm. That's probably what happened to me. Again, I do believe that the Lord opened my eyes and ears to see and hear the truth. So then friends and family would slowly start telling me, you know, oh, Peter, this, you know, this is really weird. Hey, we're here for you. You can do this. And so it was a slow process that took a couple months. But then it sped up, you know, as I started to see, the truth, the writings of Uncle Robert became more and more clear to me, that they were wicked. So, you know, he would send emails, and in the past I'd get these emails, they'd be, you know, oftentimes they'd be insulting of me because, you know, I get, he's trying to put me under his thumb and control me. But then as I started to share them with friends and family, they would read them and I would read them, and I slowly started to see, like, oh yeah, well, maybe he's not as brilliant as I thought. Oh, maybe this is wrong. Oh, he's not right here. I used to think he's always right, never wrong. Then as the light finally started to come on, it was rather quick. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I missed it. Everyone else is right. Yep. He's wrong. This is a cult. So it was a quick process. And so I think maybe to answer your question, the best way I can would be this. For years, I was always concerned with whatever he thought about whatever I said or did. Everything that went through my mind was also kind of piggybacked on, well, what would Uncle Robert think about this? What would Uncle Robert say about this? To finally be free of that, to finally be able to have a discussion with somebody, read a book, read an email, do whatever I wanted to do, whatever it was, and not have to worry what Uncle Robert thought, was incredibly freeing, you know, like lifting a huge weight off of my shoulders. Mm-hmm. And so once that happened, It's hard to describe in words, Brittany, how freeing that was for years to be under that oppression of wondering and worrying and being a little anxious. What's Uncle Robert going to say about this? To be free of that was incredible.
Wow. And actually, I want to ask another question before the next question I had. Did you have to come up with an escape plan, or could you just, you know, decide, okay, I can just really cut my contact off, or just, you know, separate myself from these people? Or how did that play out? Was there an escape plan, or just a bye?
Sure. You know, for some people, that is something they got to think about, right? Trying to escape, because let's say they live in a cult where they're all living in the same either house or building or compound. You know, let's say maybe the person in the cult is a woman who's, you know, the cult leader might be a male, could be her husband or someone else who has, you know, kind of physical control, like there's fear. How do I get out of this? And so there, I'm sure there are situations like that, probably children as well. And maybe they realize they're in a bad situation, and how do they get out? They can't live on their own. Unfortunately, I didn't have that. So my escape from the cult probably looked a little different than I would think a lot of other people being able to break free of the cult, and that I was almost kicked out, really. So my wife left me, and she left me because, you know, there was this cognitive dissonance of, well, I'm married to Peter, but he doesn't, he's always asking these questions that he doubts Uncle Robert, and Uncle Robert and I think Peter's not a Christian. He's a liar. So I'm going to leave. So since she left, it started to turn all the children against me, and it was quite awful. So it was really more her decision to kind of, you know, kick me out, let's say, which usually doesn't happen because usually the cult leaders, you know, want to maintain as much control over as many people as possible. But as soon as, you know, Paige, my former wife, had decided she was going to leave me, Uncle Robert, you know, quickly, within you know, minutes, backed her, even though biblically divorce is not right, and fully supported her. And then I, you know, instantly became the devil. I mean, they called me the devil. So fortunately, I didn't have to do that. I didn't have to, like, you know, pack up the bags in the middle of the night and sneak out, right? Fortunately, I didn't have to. But so my escape was almost 100% mental and emotional. So, Brittany, I can't imagine what people have to do if they did live in a situation where they're, you know, in a physical location where everybody believes the guru, the guy, and that person doesn't. So I've read other books, other memoirs, where they had to do that. There was a book called Daughter of Gloria Vale. This girl grew up in a little religious cult, actually about a couple hundred people, in New Zealand. And she had to leave. And she and her parents kind of discovered what was going on. And they, you know, it was kind of, not in the middle of the night, but they had to get out. They had to leave. And I've read other situations like that, which would be incredibly hard to do. But thankfully, in my situation, I didn't have to do that.
Yes. And you recovered, which is amazing. So how did you recover?
Well, I firmly believe that it was the Lord, you know, who opened my eyes to see all this. And it was through a lot of prayer, a lot of people reaching out to me and helping me and praying. So I'm one of five boys. You know, we're all old guys now, but they're all still alive, and they have wives, and my parents are still alive. And then I've got friends around the country. I grew up in New Jersey, went to college in D.C. I've lived in Colorado and Idaho, so I've got friends all over. And then friends here in Montana, where I currently live. And so, you know, I was not shy about reaching out. And you know, it was pretty obvious I needed help, right? Like, I'm kind of a tall, skinny guy. I'm 6'5". Brittany, when my wife and I left me and it became really bad, I, you know, kind of did get kicked out. I lost 30 pounds. I was 170. I was sick. I couldn't sleep. Was never suicidal, but I was not healthy. And oftentimes, guys, you know, we're kind of typical that we don't like to ask for help. I asked for help because I needed it. And so people did help me. A couple of my brothers flew out for a couple of days to be with me. My dad flew out to be with me. Not all at the same time, but, you know, staggered over this one year that was really critical in my recovery. And then a lot of friends were there. I did a little bit of counseling, but for me, it was mostly just friends, being able to talk to friends and family. And so that is so important. Again, in the Christian faith, they talk about, you know, the body of Christ, which is the body of believers. And what cults do is they isolate people. Well, I had been isolated. I came out of it. I then said, hey, here's what's been happening in my life. I need help. And people, you know, surrounded me with love and kindness. And so that's how I recovered. It took about a year, you know, from the time when she left me to when I was really like, okay, I'm now ready to really fight for my marriage and fight for my kids. And I can do this. And I'm strong enough. It was about a year. And unfortunately, the fight still goes on. I mean, it's sad because, you know, my former wife and her parents, they still, you know, follow this guy. So, you know, one day I would hope that they would see it too, because, you know, really they're victims as well. I don't think they realize it, but they are.
Wow. So you were going through a lot. Just, you know, I know how, like, you were married to someone, and I know when you're married, you're so in love, and having to try to fight for that, I just know your heart, I can't imagine how that felt. And on top of that, also recovering from being in a cult, I just cannot imagine how much pain that process was and probably still maybe is. I don't know. You know?
Yeah, I don't recommend it. It was painful. You are right. it was not fun. Very hard. It was a very challenging year. It was awful, to be quite honest. It was awful. But, you know, it was also awful being under that mind control and suffering the way I did silently for years, knowing that my wife did not respect me, did not adore me, did not revere me, probably didn't love me, loved another man, you know, not a husband and wife, but, you know, did not really adore and love me. So I suffered quietly for years. And then, of course, when she left, everything blew up. Boy, it was awful. But, you know, you got two choices, right? You either cave and give in or you fight. Mm-hmm. And the Lord gave me the courage and strength to fight for my kids, to fight for my marriage.
Yes.
So that's what I did. And I still fight for my kids today, because, you know, they know, most of them, I have five children, and certainly the youngest ones really understand it now, and they are far more healthy. They've been through a lot. It's awful what they've been through, and I wish they hadn't gone through it, but it'll make them stronger in the long run, just like it did me.
Yes, it's so heartbreaking. Oh my God, my heart. So you say you are much stronger now. So mm-hmm. Where does that strength come from?
Well, for me, it's the Lord. There's no question about it. The Lord has given me the strength. And so for, you know, your audience that, let's say, doesn't know the Bible, there's a book in the New Testament called James, and the first chapter of James, James the author says, you know, listen, if anybody lacks, you know, wisdom, you know, just ask the Lord and believe it. You know, when you ask, don't doubt. Believe he's going to give it to you. So I did. Like, it was so simple yet profound. So I started to, you know, I said, Lord, could you please give me the strength to get through today? Right? I just need to get through today. Like, I am really hurting. I'm exhausted. I'm tired. I'm scared. Please give me the strength and patience and energy to get through the day. And he would. And so then when things would happen, people would say, oh my gosh, wow, that's amazing. How did you have the strength and the bravery and the courage? You know, at times I'd be like, well, boy, I don't know. It's like, no, I do know. I know exactly how. I asked the Lord and he gave it to me. Simple as that. So, and then he also brought a lot of people around me that strengthened me and encouraged me rather than tore me down, which is what Uncle Robert did. Uncle Robert would always be tearing you down, causing you to doubt, because when you doubt, then you would have to look for him for answers, and that way he'd have more control of you. And so having lived under that oppression of always doubting myself for years, now being free of that, where, you know, friends and family would be encouraging, gave me strength. And, you know, so again, so when I say, you know, I'm a million times stronger now, that's a true statement. It is true, but, you know, it's not me. Like, it's not just me. The Lord gave me the strength, and my friends and family are there to support me. They're the ones that have, you know, given me the strength.
Yes. I know that you are fighting for your family. Have you been in contact with anyone that is inside of the cult since you've been out?
No, I would have obviously been in touch with, my wife, for, a couple of years. Unfortunately, we did get divorced. It took a long time. We were in courts for almost 3 years. We don't hardly talk at all. Unfortunately, she's very angry with me. She denies all of it. She doesn't think there's a cult. She calls, Uncle Robert would be her godfather to try and, normalize their relationship, but it's still weird. I'm convinced. I don't talk at all with my former in-laws. Don't ever see them. Don't ever talk to them. And really beyond that, there was only just a few other people. So I don't ever see them. They live in different states, different towns. So I don't ever see them. So no, I don't have any real connection with them at all. Thankfully, in my book, Stop the Tall Man, Save the Tiger, there's another guy that used to be in the cult who I call George. And I live in Montana. George lives in Idaho. George has moved away. George saw the cult. He recognized it, got out, and was not related to anybody. So it was easy for him. And you asked earlier, Paige, about, what was it like having to escape? How did you get out? And that was kind of George's situation. George found a lovely gal. They got married. And she saw right away how weird it was. And she helped George see it. So they moved away. And then when I, I'd called George, and he's like, listen, I moved. Here's where I live, but don't tell them. Don't tell, Robert and, Paige's family. I don't want them to know where I live. And so he's probably the only one I'm still in touch with that really knows, right? Like, we know what we've been through. And really, I can tell you what we went through, but unless you've actually experienced it, it's, it's hard to really know what it was like. So I'm still in touch with him, but that's about it.
How have you adjusted to your new life? Like, how did you adjust to life outside of it?
Well, my new life now changed in many ways. So I'm a single dad now, so with three kids at home. I love being a dad. Being a single dad is hard. The Lord knew what he was doing when he gave children two parents, a mom and a dad. It's just a lot of work. But I do my best. Again, I rely on the Lord for strength and patience every day. So I'm very busy. Thankfully, I'm not alone. When you've been married over 20 years, then you become single. Yeah, it's kind of lonely at times, but, I'm just busy being a dad. I'm an author. I'm working on my third book. And I have a job, so I keep very busy. So those are certainly challenging aspects of my life. But the particulars about being in the cult, like these little conferences that I talked about, or the constant doubt that I always had because of Uncle Robert. Oh boy, I don't miss any of that. Mm-hmm. And, it's such a, it's like a, living in gray, gloomy, cold, cloudy weather for 20 years. Now all of a sudden you've moved to Arizona and it's blue sky and sunshine every day. So that's nice. But I still have challenges, right? Like, when you divorce and your family kind of implodes on you, it's going to affect you for years and years. And it still does. But that's okay. Life is challenging. And you do your best every day. One thing I've learned, being a single dad, is that every day you wake up, you and I, Brittany, everybody else, you wake up and you've got only a certain amount of physical, mental, emotional, spiritual energy, like every day. And some days at the end of the day, you just run out. Don't talk to me right now because I have no more emotional energy and I might get angry and snap at you. I'm done. Go to bed, right? Mm-hmm. And some days, you run out of physical energy or emotional energy at 10 o'clock at night. Some days you run out at 9 a.m. It's just the way it is. You had a tough morning. And so there are nights where it's like, I'm cutting my losses. I'm going to bed. I'm done. I've just run out of energy. But I know the next day I'm going to wake up with a full tank. I'll have energy, emotional, mental, spiritual, physical, and I can do it. And I just take it day by day.
Yes. So how has your perspective on religion or spirituality shifted since leaving the cults?
Great question, Brittany. And I can answer that. And it's a really simple answer. The message of the Bible, of the gospel, is that salvation is a free gift. So there's nothing you or I or anybody else can do to earn it. And so anybody that tries to tell you that you need to do or think certain things to be saved by the Lord, whether it's you have to, you know, you have to go to church, you have to tithe, you have to do this, you have to believe this thing, do this or that, is trying to act as a gatekeeper to God. And that's exactly what Uncle Robert did. And that was the most wicked part of his theology, that really you weren't saved until he said you were. And that could be true for any religion, not just Christianity. And so now, while I always knew that, it really has hit home. That, listen, I don't have to believe one word of what Uncle Robert said or anybody like him. It only matters what the Lord thinks. And the Lord, for some reason, in his infinite wisdom, graciously chose to give me salvation. He gave it to me. It's a free gift. And yeah, I accept it. Yeah, I believe. But there's really no bragging about it. There's nothing to say, look at me, look what I've done. It's a gift. And it's available to anybody. And so that's really kind of the foundation of Christianity. And it certainly has even more meaning to me now after what I've been through.
What advice would you give to someone who is currently involved in a cult or knows someone who is?
Well, for the person who's in a cult, number one, they probably don't know it. And so number two, they wouldn't think they needed help. There may be, you know, organizations that really are quite obviously a cult. And so then people on the outside would say, hey, you are in a cult. But that person would deny it, right? So they wouldn't believe it. I don't know what it would take for those people, you know, to see it. I do know that they would have to be removed from that situation. You know, a friend or a family member would have to try and get the person one-on-one to help them see. But the other part of your question, you know, well, what advice would you give to someone that, let's say, knows somebody? So let's say, Brittany, you've got a cousin, right? I don't know. Who you think is in a cult. You know, first of all, just love the person. Be patient with the person. It's going to take time. It could take a lot of time. Like it took me. But really, you've got to be able to talk to that person without another member of the cult there. Because, you know, there would be times where I would share a few things that Uncle Robert would say with somebody outside the cult. So a friend or a family member. And they'd be like, oh my gosh, Peter, this is bizarre. You know, what about this, this, and this? And they, you know, oh, maybe they're right. And then sure enough, I'd go back and talk to my wife or Uncle Robert. Oh, no, no, that person was evil and wicked and crazy. And they don't know any better. And then you get stuck right back in. So the key is to be able to talk to this loved one or friend. And you know, again, be patient and loving. But to be able to share with them without another member of the cult then reversing all of what you just told that person. And that's hard to do. But it can be done. Happened with me, right?
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to share about your experience in a cult and your journey to recovery, or any very striking or impactful moments during your time in a cult?
Sure. Here's one other thing I would like to share. Everybody remembers COVID. Right? You know, when we all had to kind of stay at home and all these crazy lockdowns and all that nonsense. And So my kids, you know, at school. And so what I did during that time was continuing to work. I wrote for about 4 to 5 hours a day and finished my book, my memoir, Stop the Tall Man, Save the Tiger. Well, the reason I'm telling you this is not to just try and sell a book, but because writing it down was very therapeutic and cathartic. Writing down what happened to me, my story. It's hard to describe how helpful that was to be able to connect all the dots. Here's what happened to me. Now it all makes sense. And it made sense because I wrote it down. And I didn't plan on writing a book and publishing it, but I just kept writing. It just came out of me. And so it was so helpful to do it. And so, yeah, then I did publish the book this year. But for other people, and let's say you're not even in the cult, if you've gone through a difficult circumstance or are going through a difficult circumstance, you know, journal, diary, do whatever. It is so helpful to get it down in writing. Because then you can also look back, you know, well, wait a minute, what happened last fall or last summer? And then you've got it in writing because our memories will fail us.
Right.
And that was another lesson that I learned. Boy, writing it down really helps.
Yes. I know we've all been through, like, you know, like, just really tough times and really hard times, maybe traumatic events. And I know, like, I've been through a really tough time during COVID. At first, it was very hard to write it because writing it, I just felt like I was reliving it, and it hurted so bad to write it down. I could talk about it some, but it was so hard to write it at first. But once I started to write it down, oh my gosh, it was so therapeutic, and I started to feel so much better. I was in therapy, and when I say I came a long way, just a whole 180 from that dark time in my life when it was something traumatic that happened. And I also would like to...
You go ahead.
I would like to go into your book. You mentioned that you have a book called Stop the Tall Man, Save the Tiger. I would like you to tell us about that, but what were you going to say first?
Oh, I was going to say, you know, with your situation, you know, if you look back, I wonder how many people really knew what you were going through. So with my situation, you know, because of the secrecy of the cult, I didn't tell anybody for a long time. I didn't tell my family that my wife had left me for about 4 months. So I remember about 9 months after she had left, and I was really struggling, but I was getting better. You know, and I would drive around town. I'd have red puppy eyes from bawling my eyes out, and I lost weight. I would walk and walk and walk because I couldn't sit down because of all the anxiety and fear. I couldn't even sit at my desk, so I'd walk around town. You know, finally, in the afternoon, I'd calm down. I'd get sit down and do some work. So we had a staff meeting. I sell real estate, and everybody got together, and I asked the owner, like, listen, he knew what was going on. I said, can I tell everybody else? He said, sure. So at the staff meeting, there's like 20 people there. And I told her about what was going on. And I thought for sure, Brittany, they would know. Like, again, I lost 30 pounds. I got red puffy eyes at work every day. Nobody knew. Nobody had any idea what I was going through. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a lot of people in your life that didn't know what you were going through.
You're right.
The lesson here is, you know, if you go to the grocery store and the clerk is rude, or you're driving on the highway and the guy cuts you off, you don't know what they're going through. Who knows what tough time they are suffering with? So be kind, right? Be mm-hmm. kind to people.
Yep, that's true. And a lot of people did not know. And it was hard to say it now. But, you know, I just felt I was moved to go ahead and say it. But, yeah, a lot of people did not know.
So my book, Stop the Tall Man, Save the Tiger, it's available on Amazon. Was released in March of 2023. People who read it, boy, they love it. It's hard to put down. It's you can't make this stuff up, right? Like, somebody told me I should just turn it into a novel, and I said, well, nobody would believe it. So it is a memoir. Sales are going well. I think your audience would love it. Fascinating story. At the time, it's very heartbreaking and intense and hard to read, but it's hard to put down. And there is, you know, a good, strong message at the end. So it does end on a positive note. So the title, people are like, what in the world, Stop the Tall Man, Save the Tiger? Well, to add kind of a layer of, you know, mystery and complexity to all this, Brittany, my former wife, Paige, had a dream before we met. And she had this really interesting, weird dream that was obviously a big deal to her. And she then wrote a letter to Uncle Robert. Again, this is like a month before she met me, about it. And I believe the Lord gave her this dream as a warning about him, but he twisted the dream, turned it around 180 degrees, and used that dream to convince Paige that she was not a Christian, she wasn't saved, and she needed Uncle Robert to save her. And then I, you know, kind of became the bad guy, and Uncle Robert, who really was, I believe, the tiger, you know, the bad dude, the enemy, the danger in the dream, he became the knight in shining armor. And I didn't realize this till like 20 years later. So that's where the title came from. And it is absolutely fascinating. That discovery that I made, you know, nearly 20 years after the fact, I practically fell off my chair because Uncle Robert wrote this long, like 23-page letter, 2-page, and she got it like right after we met, but she'd had the dream about a month before we met. And this tall man in her dream is somebody that she can't see his face because she hadn't met me yet. And I'm 6'5", and Uncle Robert's like 5'6", and yet he tried to pretend that he was the tall man and convinced Paige that she wasn't saved. So that dream that was you know, it was a warning. It was a warning and a way out the page. But sadly, she didn't see it. And Uncle Robert was able to turn it on its head and maintain control of her. So that's where the title came from. And it is a fascinating story that I really do think your audience would enjoy.
Yes, I believe so too. And I remember we mentioned that everybody is usually going through something, you know, no matter how big or small, and usually no one knows, so be kind. Tell us what it was that helped you see this.
You know, the lesson that everybody's going through something really hit home with me when I had that meeting at my office and I told everybody what was going on in my life. And I thought it was so obvious, right? Like, here I am, this guy that's, you know, moping at work, you know, red puppy eyes, lost 30 pounds, you know, just shuffling around town. You know, obviously, I thought I looked like a wreck. And nobody knew. Nobody had any idea. And I thought, oh, my goodness. So if I'm going through this, right, and I look this bad, and to me it's this obvious and nobody knew, well, what about the other people that are going through things that maybe aren't as serious? But we have no idea. So I remember about a month before that staff meeting where I told everybody in my office, hey, my wife left me, you know, she took the kids, it's a really bad situation. Before I told them all that, there was another coworker that she was going through a bit of a tough time. And it wasn't life-altering. It was really her contract at work, right? She was a little disappointed, and she eventually left and got a different job. But she was sharing all this with me. And at the time, it was really helpful because I had been spending so much time focused on me and my, you know, poor me and what I'm going through. And everybody was reaching out and helping me. She didn't know it. So she was, you know, kind of leaning on me for advice. And what should I do? And I was happy to help her out in that moment. But then a month later, you know, at the staff meeting, when I told everybody she was there, she was floored. She had no idea that this is what I'd been going through. And a lot of people, when they read the book, Brittany, you know, that lesson kind of pops off the page. Like, it's pretty easy to see. Like, oh my goodness, yeah, that's an obvious lesson, right?
Mm-hmm.
We are so focused on ourselves at times that we miss what are obvious signs.
Mm-hmm.
My friend is
that's true.
Cousin, my sister, they're hurting. I need to ask them why.
That's true. I've also been on the outside of that many times, you know, and I thought I mastered it. And I came to a real shocking realization that I didn't, because I've had friends in the past that I've been to school with that's been on my podcast and that has shared stories about the signs and paying attention. And I thought, okay, I done heard all these stories. I got it. I know how to pay attention. I can recognize it. And I'm there for people and usually seeing how everybody is. But it was a situation where somebody was going through something, and I would see them a lot quite often, and I had no idea. And The person told me that all of the signs and stuff, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I thought I knew. I thought I mastered it at this point, and I had no idea. So I have been on the outside, and I'm like, wow. So, yeah, we definitely have to pay attention, because we would think that we would know, or we would think that other people would know. And it's sometimes we're so focused on ourselves, like you said, that we can miss it.
Right. And it doesn't take much, right, Brittany? It just takes the, hey, are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
Literally, that's all. Hey, are you doing okay? That's about all it takes, really. And then that person will hopefully just say, oh my gosh, I'm glad you asked. And then they just pour it out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you also wrote a novel about faith and basketball. Tell us about that book.
Yeah. So that book is called The Blue Team, and I published that a few years ago. And so, yeah, it's about faith and basketball and identifying your greatest adversary. So the idea is that if you're a basketball player, which the book, you know, again, is about loosely based on my time playing basketball in college, that your greatest adversary, your greatest opponent, is not the guy trying to block your shot, it's not the teammate who won't pass you the ball, it's not the coach who won't play you enough, it's your own mind. We are truly our own worst enemy. And so when the Lord saves you, he really saves you from yourself. So just because, you know, you become a believer and a Christian doesn't mean you're going to, you know, be the next Michael Jordan. But you can have, let's say, the peace of mind to take the game-winning shot. You might not make it, but you'll have the peace of mind to take it because you know it's not the end of the world. Your life is not wrapped up in what you do, but who you are. So I am, first and foremost, a believer. I'm a Christian, son of God. What I do is I love to write and tell stories. And you love to tell stories as well, Brittany. You're a podcaster. Mm-hmm. We all the things that we do, but the important part is to put our identity in something greater than ourselves. For me, that's the Lord. So I'm actually working on a sequel. Hope to have that published in 2024. Don't have a title yet, but that will come out. And I love writing. I love telling stories. I think we all have a story to tell. And that's how we learn. You know, we learn big ideas, important themes, and principles through stories.
Yes. Well, this has been an amazing interview. It was very vulnerable. I learned so much.
Good.
And it was just amazing. But before we go, can I just get a little bit about your sports background? I wanted to ask two questions about your sports background before we go.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me one or some of your most memorable stories from your career in sports broadcasting.
Well, I was never, you know, a famous sports broadcaster, you know, like Al Michaels or Jim Nance or Bob Costas. I wanted to do, but never was. But what makes my story, I think, unique is that I covered a lot of non-traditional sports. So literally, I did curling. I've done rodeo. I've done adventure racing in North Africa. I've done skiing and cycling, beach soccer, rock climbing. I mean, you name it. Lumberjack sports. On and on and on. The list goes on. I probably only listed about half the sports I've done. So I've got to go to some really crazy places. You know, I remember doing a lumberjack event in Alaska, you know, right along the coast. I remember being in Morocco in the Sahara Desert, you know, covering these runners that are running marathons every day. And then I've been all over the U.S., you know, covering small town rodeos. And then I've also done, you know, basketball and football games, college for ESPN. And, you know, ESPN used to do the top 10 every night, right? And there was a couple times that one of my calls from a game that I called made the top 10 list. So that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. I remember, funny story. So, you know, the Olympics are like the pinnacle of sports, right? You know, the greatest athletes in the world go to the Olympics. So a long time ago, 1998, I did the Olympic trials for the U.S. for the Winter Games. And I went to Duluth, Minnesota to cover the curling Olympic trials. So, you know, curling is kind of an odd, unique sport, right? And so the winning team just punched their ticket to the Olympics. They're going to the, you know, the pinnacle of athletic achievement. And the captain of the team had a Budweiser in one hand and a cigarette in the other while I interviewed him. And so I thought, well, this is odd. Here's, you know, this guy going to compete against the greatest athletes in the world. And he's drinking a Bud and smoking a drag. But that's curling. Curling is, it's got its own unique personality and following. And yeah, I've got a lot of stories from my broadcasting career. And really, you know, as a sports broadcaster, you know, the thing I miss the most is the camaraderie. You travel around the country. We're like a bunch of gypsies, right? Like we go home to our families. And then on the weekend, we all get on a plane and we fly together and we call an event, we call a game, and we go back home. And we travel around the country doing this. And so all the people who compete in lumberjack events, you know, see each other every weekend at events. And then all the people that compete in mountain biking see each other at events on the weekend. And so these little communities of gypsies traveling around the country, you know, competing in events separately. And they all do it on their own. They all know each other. And it's fascinating, and it's so much fun.
What do you mean when you say sports is the perfect metaphor for life?
Well, I have been around sports my whole life. So I played and coached college basketball. I was a sports broadcaster for a long time, and now I've written a novel about sports, and I'm working on another one. And so I love using sports as a metaphor for life. And we do it all the time, right? Like if you had a good podcast, you might say, wow, I hit a home run. This is the baseball analogy, right? You know, or if we're running out of time, the clock is winding down, right? We're in the fourth quarter. We're running out of time. We use these analogies all the time. And to me, sports can teach us so much about life. When we play sports, and not all of us are going to be great at it, can become a pro, but we can all learn life lessons like discipline, hard work, respect for authority, being a good teammate, following the rules, setting goals, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can then use that in your life as an actress, as a podcaster, as a storyteller, as a writer. You know, like if you have a deadline and you've got to get something done, boy, it's headed into overtime, right? We got to get this done. And, you know, in the Bible, Christ spoke in what we call parables, right? Well, they're just little stories. And he used agriculture most of the time, right? He was constantly talking about, you know, like the tares and the wheat or the fruit of the spirit. And because his audience understood agriculture. Well, I understand sports. So then I can use analogies from sports, and it's applicable to every area of our life. Listening to a coach, right? Being able to communicate well. Well, you've got to communicate with people at the office, at school, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Right now, I feel just how a person would feel when they've just won a game, because it feels so good to be free. And thinking back on that story of that short period in 2020, I'm just thinking about, man, how far I've came from that rough patch. It just feels so good to be feeling good. So,
yeah.
And I'm sure you feel so good to be free from being in that club, no, free from all of the oppression, and just, you know, even though we still have stuff to work on, you know, it's life, but yeah.
Yep. It's freeing. And, I love being able to share my story, and use it as a cautionary tale to encourage others and also maybe educate others. And so, yeah, Brittany, thanks for the opportunity to share my story with your audience, because, again, I think it's an important one, and I am happy to share it.
And I'm so happy you came on the podcast and shared it. This has been an amazing interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Brittany. I've loved it.
And make sure you all check out his website. I will have it in the description, and I will have the links to his books in the description. He has a lot of really great detailed reviews that tell you how good it is. So yeah, make sure you guys check that out. I've read a little bit, but yeah, so yeah, thank you again.
Thank you so much, Brittany.